Perinatal Stories Australia.
Welcome to Perinatal Stories Australia. My name is Rebecca, and every episode we provide a listening ear to the lived experiences of mental illness during pregnancy and postpartum. I hope this podcast reduces stigma, informs listeners about support services available, and inspires those on their own healing journey. More importantly, I hope you can hear these stories and know you're not alone. Thank you for being here to hold space for the stories we often keep to ourselves. This episode of Perinatal Stories Australia is proudly brought to you by Tommy Tippy Australia. Tommy Tippy was founded over half a century ago, born from a mission to make life easier for parents. For decades, they've been designing products that enhance a parent's intuition and engineering solutions to make caring for babies easier, simpler, and more instinctive. You've got this, we've got you. Hi everyone, I'm joined today by Caitlin, who is a midwife running her own pregnancy care centre in far north Queensland. So I'm going to pick her brain a little bit about that later. But for now, I just want to start by saying thank you. I'm so honoured you're here today.
Thank you so much. I'm honoured to be here. It's a huge privilege. So yeah, to be sitting here with you. You're doing amazing things and I love it.
Thank you. Before we start your story, Caitlin, I guess there's something that I've been reflecting on. I was really torn about whether I needed to add like a content note or something about ECT. Who don't know, that's electroconvulsive therapy. Now, I don't like doing content notes. I don't know. Anyway, but the point I'm making is it really got me thinking about how there are still so many taboos and stigmas when it comes to mental health. And as a society, you know, we're finally starting to open up about mental health. But the reality is we're only talking about things that are palatable. You know, like maybe some symptoms of anxiety or, you know, going to therapy, like the easy stuff, things that people are comfortable consuming. But there's so many layers of mental health that we don't talk about for whatever reason. Like maybe we're just starting to skim the surface of talking about taking psychiatric medication for our mental health. But even that's still so controversial and can be so taboo. And then there's another layer around a psychiatric hospital admission. That's another thing we sweep under the rug. But then even under that, other or above that, whichever way we're going, the fact that there are psychiatric treatments that aren't therapy or medication, things like ECT, which aren't palatable or aren't easy to sit with, they're not comfortable to talk about.
It's
seen as such a big bad wolf, right? And as a society, we don't talk about that, maybe because we don't want to scare people. You know, we want people to get on board with mental health. We want them to be comfortable. But I always wonder about what a disservice that does. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is being here and, you know, your story covers a lot of these, let's say, taboos. I'm using that in inverted commas, but I just know that this is going to be a really big step in broadening the conversations about mental health and making it less scary for someone else. So thank you, truly.
No, I'm very excited to talk about it. It's definitely much less painful than it used to be. And I always feel like it creates that awareness and it may encourage someone to say how they really feel rather than sugarcoating it. So that's always my goal.
Yeah, and it's a very honourable goal and we share the same goal. So thank you.
Love that.
Love that. Background on you. You're a midwife with absolutely no previous history of mental ill health, and depression or anxiety didn't even appear in your first pregnancy or postpartum. It's something that hit with your second, I believe, about 6 months postpartum.
Yeah, and like when I reflect, probably in hindsight, it probably did start, maybe there were probably a few red flags throughout pregnancy.
Yeah.
And I think that was unfortunately the era of COVID. So I pretty much returned post my first baby to work already pregnant with my second one.
Wow.
So yeah, there was quite a quick turnaround there. And we're very excited, but COVID kind of happened. And because I am a midwife working with the hospital system, we didn't know anything about that yet.
Yeah.
So there were a few guidelines thrown out at that time that, you know, if you can't work from home and you're into your third trimester, that you were better off to remove yourself from that area and work from home. But as a midwife, you can't work from home unless you're privately working during home birth. So We made a choice that it's probably because we didn't know what it did to babe that I would take my mat leave early. And, you know, that was probably the first step to that, like removing myself from my place that I love to socialize and work. And so that was probably the first step to that, I reckon.
I can imagine. And in terms of, I guess, the symptoms of anxiety or even the red flags in pregnancy that you kind of pushed away, what did that look like?
That probably looked like feeling very overwhelmed. My husband is also in the medical profession and he does shift work and on call. And when he's on call, he's about 45 minutes away. And I was very much with my first baby, like kind of just did everything. Like I probably definitely didn't embrace my village because my parents lived in Melbourne and I'm in Cairns. And we do have Andy's parents up here, but I definitely didn't embrace that village to seek support and help because I just kind of did it by myself. So I think when I went on mat leave early and I was pregnant, I had a lot of pelvic pain. It was really hard to look after a, you know, between 12 and 14 months over that time. Very active, very wild child, like, and keeping up with that was really hard. And I definitely felt feelings of being overwhelmed and, you know, more than just emotional pregnancy emotion. It was much, in hindsight, it was definitely much more than that. Yeah. And frustration at times. And just thinking about how I was going to manage essentially two babies.
Yeah. It's my current dilemma.
Yeah, I feel that.
You've gotten through pregnancy as hard as that has been. You've gotten through birth and things, from what I understand, were okay, or you didn't notice that they weren't okay until about 6 months postpartum.
I would probably, so, you know, the birth was really nice. Like, birth's definitely my favorite part. and I definitely do that the best. so I came out of that feeling pretty good, but I think it was just, so Andy always takes about 6 weeks off. So we did that again. And then it was probably on his return to work that I started to feel really overwhelmed by that. Because I, in my head leading into this, I was like, you know, I did it with my first by myself, I'll just do the same. And clearly that's not like reality. Like, so I think I set myself up with that and then I couldn't do that. And then having to ask for help was really, really hard. And I think, you know, seeking support from not, you know, as much as Andy's family is my family, they're still not my family. And those sorts of like, they don't have to accept me for how I'm presenting at the moment or what I'm saying at the moment or what I'm feeling at the moment. But in my head, my family, who my blood family, have to and they will. So to ask people that are not my blood family to support and help me during this time was really, really hard. Yeah, and they wanted to help, and
of course,
but I just couldn't get past that. And being COVID, living in Cairns and my family living in Melbourne, like I may as well have lived on the moon, you know, like there was no way them getting up here was going to be possible. Yeah, and upon Andy's return to work, like I just felt very isolated. And then I sort of fell into this very rigid, I can't leave the house because my baby needs to sleep. And then like getting up all night, breastfeeding. And then I felt the mental and physical load of breastfeeding. And then I started to resent that. And then I felt like, if I'm not enjoying breastfeeding my baby, like what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
And then it's just like those spiral thoughts. And I definitely remember saying the word earth mother a few times, like I'm not an earth mother because I'm not enjoying breastfeeding, like what's wrong with me? And then that social media portrayal of, you know, the mother that enjoys wearing her baby 24/7, co-sleeping, breastfeeding. And for me, I wanted that separation. I couldn't handle that constant touch at that time.
Yeah, being touched out, you know, you're human and we do get touched out, but it's so easy to turn that on ourselves and blame ourselves and wonder what's wrong with us.
And I just had no concept of that other people felt like that, you know, that other people maybe didn't enjoy breastfeeding. Or, you know, I think I went into it thinking I should love every day. Every day of parenting should be amazing and I should find happiness and joy And the more that I didn't find that, the more I didn't find any joy.
That's such a big thing, and it's such a big expectation to enjoy every moment or every day. And it is perpetuated online, especially. There's not many communities that talk about, well, it's actually okay if you don't like it all day.
Yeah. And I do remember my first, like, eventually when I got to the psychology appointment, I remember that first one, that's, she said that to me, and I was like, really?
Really?
Like, yeah. That's okay.
And I mean, you having had no history whatsoever with anxiety or depression, I can only imagine what that was like. It was awful for me experiencing that postpartum, but I'd had many, many years of that as an experience. So I'm just sitting here thinking, gosh, how that must have felt as a second time mum, you know, experiencing these symptoms that you have never experienced before. So
Yeah, and I think and as a midwife, we counsel people about this, but I definitely would have been mindlessly counseling people about it because I had no actual understanding of it. So, you know, that was really hard that I, you know, that feeling of like, once I experienced it and I'm like, oh, and then I sort of felt like, did I let all these women down that I maybe didn't support, or, you know, so there was a component of that as well.
Of course. And that was actually going to be one of my questions is, as a midwife, your understanding of PMDA, having never gone through it yourself prior to this point, what was your understanding of PMDA and where did that, I guess, stop? You know, what was the limit of your understanding?
I guess I anticipated that having some sort of history lead, like, you know, increase your risk of getting it after. But I guess in my head, I was like, I have a house, I have two healthy, lovely children, I have a very extremely supportive husband, I work in this industry. How have I ended up like this? Like, I don't deserve to be feeling like this. I don't have enough bad stuff happening to me to feel like this. So I think my thoughts previously were that you need to have quite a drastic social situation to experience that, which is like, and when you actually look at the statistics, it's like professionals that are higher risk of having PND and PNA. So,
And I mean, I relate so much to that. It becomes internalized. Like, I don't have risk factors. There are other women who do. What's wrong with me? So, yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah, and then you get fed these lines of like, well, you know, just be grateful that you have two lovely, healthy children and there's nothing wrong with them. And I just fed it. It just grew and it grew and it grew from like those teeny tiny little comments.
Yeah.
Which are not meant in a harmful way, but, yeah, they have a huge impact. And I think it's always when you go to expose yourself or reach out to someone and that's what you get, then you're like, well, I'm not going to talk about it anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's just not the right thing to say.
No, it just makes you feel worse, right? So I believe you reached out to your GP at around the 6-month postpartum mark. Can I ask what prompted you to decide, no, I need help? And what was that experience like with the GP?
Well, I guess what perpetuated the visit is I just didn't feel right. My face does not feel right. And my anxiety presents in fight or flight and anger, like rage, not towards my children, but to myself. I do get passionate, but I don't get angry. So I'm like, this is not okay. So I spoke to Andy. I'm like, look, I think I need to go and have a chat to my GP. And I found, you know, I didn't really see a GP normally. So I had to find someone, and I have a very great GP and she is lovely. And I went, but I definitely lied on all those tests that they tell you because I was still feeling vulnerable. But the even on lying, what I was scoring out was still not normal. And presenting in that COVID time, obviously the first line is like, we talk about it, we do the questionnaires, then we talk about, you know, she created a mental health plan for me, but then we actually had to find a psychologist that has availability. You know, like the lady up here who is amazing and is now my psychologist, this was November and I couldn't get anywhere near seeing her till February.
Wow.
So I ended up getting him with someone else, which I went to, but we didn't click. And, you know, perinatal is such a niche.
Yeah.
And you got to have someone that knows what they're doing in that space. So
definitely. And I guess along that kind of train of thought, the impact of living somewhere that's not a major city. Not that Cairns is exactly regional. It's a city in its own right. But the reality is it does not have the same, or at least the same number of facilities or services like somewhere like Brisbane would have. And I just wanted to know if you had a comment on that, because I can only imagine the impact that that has. Waiting, what, 3 months to see a psychologist when you've already waited X number of months. And that's heartbreaking.
Yeah, the resources. And that's what I was about to find out. Like, the lack of resources and the lack of experience in this space was definitely about to draw out my, before I got any recovery sign of any, like, non-acute phase. Like, it was about to get worse. So I did one appointment with the psychologist and I was like, well, that, I don't think she's... And at that point, I was like, well, it's not useful. It's not going to help. Like, and then I think I had a review booked a month later with my GP. And then that's when we discussed medication. That obviously comes with a lot of hesitation.
Yes. Those taboos, that stigma.
The taboo. Yeah. And I was like, you know, I did a lot of reading about it. I had a discussion with a friend who had also had anxiety within her pregnancies, and you know, she helped me and reassured me. Andy helped me and reassured me. So we gave it a go and it did not work.
No. And from what I understand as well, you went on a different medication and even that didn't work.
No. So, you know, I have to wait for that 2 week before it kicks in, and it just did not touch the sides at all. And it just kept going. We switched to something else. 2 weeks, that didn't work. And then by this time it's December. And we know what Christmas is like.
Mm-hmm.
So that build up of Christmas and trying to make everything perfect for my kids.
Yeah.
And to be that, to look like I'm that mother who's creating that magic for their children.
Yeah.
And, you know, that one of my lowest points was Christmas Day. Andy was supposed to go off to work that day. And I had an epic panic attack, and there were panic attacks sort of leading up to this. And then leading up to that, that's when those, trigger warning here for anybody, intrusive thoughts that then became a plan. And that was for someone who could never understand how someone could take their own life. I was suddenly quite willing to, which was definitely where it had to, so I spent my Christmas 2020 in ED.
Yeah, so you recognized this in yourself and you presented yourself to the emergency department, which I think is, you know, credit to you for doing that, for going to emergency and getting that help. I know it's Christmas,
I was definitely not alone on Christmas Day in ED, unfortunately. It's such a build-up of a day for people, so I have full understanding of that now.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you were then admitted to a psychiatric ward for 2 months because I think you'd written on your submission form that you were scared to go home.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that's that fear of not having someone keeping an eye on you at all times kind of thing.
Yeah, so it was a very interesting road to that admission. Like, you know, the Christmas Day presentation was a bit of a band-aid fix where Andy actually had to severely advocate for me to be reviewed and, you know, not just sort of been like, oh, you'll be okay. We'll give you some medication to deal with the breakthrough anxiety and then, you know, just follow up with your GP. And, you know, at that point he was like, we've done all this. This is not, I can't keep her safe. And I think we definitely both understood at that point and now what the importance of that collateral history is and actually listening to the person that knows that person better than you do. So it was definitely a big learning curve for both of us.
And that's huge that he, I guess, took that initiative and took that step, because I can imagine a lot of partners might not be comfortable having that conversation, especially if they have zero experience with mental ill health, you know, not knowing, you know, are the doctors right or are they right in this situation? Do I really know my partner best, et cetera?
Yeah.
That's huge. Yeah. So, yeah, credit to him too.
Yeah, yeah. And he definitely had to fight, not fight, but sort of advocate for me a few times because I think, you know, the lack of resources up here is that lack of experience within the perinatal space. So techniques that work outside of the perinatal space don't work in this situation, which is,
unfortunate.
Yeah, very unfortunate. So I remember that, like I didn't want to go home, but they kind of made me feel like that was, I didn't need to be there, like I wasn't bad enough. Whatever that even means.
And yet this was your crisis point.
That was my crisis point, yeah. And I think it also comes down to like how we were talking about your history, how you don't have any of those tick boxes. Like I do have a support system or those protective measures, but he couldn't protect me anymore.
And so you got that review because your husband advocated for you?
Yeah.
What did that lead to?
That led to follow-up with that acute care crisis team, which were really good. And then I think at that point we do have a perinatal outpatient team, which I think I don't, and some of my memory is a bit fuzzy at this point, but they did end up participating in my care. But then I think I presented two more times to ED, and on that third time I was actually admitted, and then that's when I was admitted for about 8 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. At that point, yeah. And obviously we have no mum and baby unit here, so it was just me within the mental health unit, which was frightening.
Yeah, we're talking another level of mental health taboo.
Yeah.
You've crossed that bridge of, okay, maybe I have to take medication. You're now being admitted to a psychiatric ward. You know, what was that like? And coming to that decision with your care team at the time, like how was that?
Oh, man, the extra layer to this is like, this is the place that, this is my workplace.
Yeah,
like,
okay.
As well. Like, this is where I work. So I remember, you know, and you can't, you're not allowed, you get escorted from ED down to where you're going and you have to have a security guard with you and you're in a wheelchair. You can't walk, like you're not allowed to walk. Andy wasn't allowed to come with me. So obviously you're in a wheelchair with a security guard and a nurse that's pushing you into this area of the hospital that I've never been before. And, you know, then I didn't have anything, but whatever I did have, like my handbag was put away and I was in a room and, you know, with people that are also in at their crisis point to different degrees with all different mental health problems. Yeah, so that was extremely terrifying. Yeah, I couldn't believe I got to that point.
If you're feeling overwhelmed by the sheer amount of information out there, don't worry, you're not the only one. Today's sponsor, Tommy Tippy, believes that all parents deserve access to expert advice and support. That's why they've curated a team of knowledgeable and experienced experts who are passionate about what they do and dedicated to helping parents navigate the ups and downs of parenthood. Their simple guides cover a range of topics from pregnancy to toddlers to postpartum and parenting, including a topic very close to my heart, parental mental health. Visit the Parent Library at tommytippy.com.au to find expert advice that empowers your intuition. And how were those 8 weeks? You know, I'm wondering if you felt safe there, if you felt better after the 8 weeks, like what's happening in these 8 weeks? Because that's a long time. That is 2 months.
Yeah. So I would definitely say in the first 2 weeks, there was a lot of changes in medications because we were still, it was very treatment resistant. Like we were still trying to find something that worked. And, you know, there were a couple of times where like Andy would come and visit and they'd encourage me to have like an hour's leave and go for a walk with him. And then we ate something and then we came back. And then the next day I was reviewed and then like, oh, so you're happy now. Like you look like you enjoyed that. And I'm like, well, you told me to do that. and then it kind of escalated to like, well, do you have PND? Do you have PNA? Do you have bipolar? And then I was like, okay, like, I don't know where this is coming from. That was very confronting. And at that point, I think Andy had to advocate again that he's like, well, I think we need something more, some more experience in here. And that's at that point, I was incredibly lucky that the perinatal mental health outpatient team actually stepped in and looked after me as an inpatient.
Wow.
And at that point, when I had my first meeting with them, was just like a turning point. I went into that room and they got it. They understood. And then they're like, this is exactly what is going on for you.
Right. And sometimes we need that, like just hearing the other doctors doubt you. Mm. Oh, do you even have depression when you had one good day? Like,
So it was a very interesting experience to have that. And then it switches into this, am I making this up?
Yeah.
Like it was very strange.
Yeah. No, I can only imagine. And I'm so glad that perinatal team were able to look after you as an inpatient.
Oh, they are like, they saved my life. Like,
yeah,
man. And there was a whole change in medication. We went really old school to overcome the crisis. And then I had done my own research into ECT because I was like, this medication changing is just, you know what it's like with the side effects, and then it doesn't work, you know? And I was like, well, maybe this is a road to go on. And then so I floated that with them and they were like, well, I'm glad you brought it up because we were going to bring it up, but it's so taboo.
Yeah.
And as soon as you mention that term, people think, what is that, one flew over the cuckoo's nest? Like that movie, that's exactly what people go to. And that's exactly what my parents went to when I told them.
Okay, so a few things I want to unpick here. So you were the one who brought up ECT. Mm.
Yeah, because I was admitted at that time, I had met another mum who was sort of further down the track than me, and she ECT had worked well for her. And then I met someone else who had a ECT and they had found it very helpful. So then I was like, well, I discussed it with Andy and we looked at it from the perinatal health view and he did a bit of research and we just wanted to see what the perinatal outpatient team thought. And that's what they were like. That's what we were thinking. We didn't want to scare you, but that's what we were thinking. Yeah.
And I'm glad you could have that conversation with Andy as well and be open and work together to decide, is this going to be right for you? Like, that's phenomenal.
Yeah. And, you know, watching me, like where I was, my brain was completely broken. Like I was so not the person that he knew, and he like copped it. Like the frustration and the rage and how I would voice my frustration at him and I would walk out of the house and he wouldn't know where I was. And like, there was so many components that he had to sort of deal with leading into this admission.
I can only imagine. And this admission, we're talking 8 weeks. You're not with your kids, right? Or at least you might get to see them occasionally, but, you know, a psych ward's not really a fun place for kids.
No, I was allowed. So as my medication worked, I did try to get home at dinner time, but yeah, so I would do that and then he would drive me back. And at this point my mum had come up from Melbourne and she was living in the granny flat to sort of help. And so Andy had to take long service leave from the hospital and all that to help. So, yeah, and he was, you know, doing as much as he could for me as well as looking after the kids. And then my mum was looking after the kids and then, you know, it was, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard. And I am so glad to hear that they were able to step up for you.
Yeah, and I think I couldn't, like, more than an hour at home, like, I couldn't do that. Like, that was enough, before I got too anxious and,
Had to go back.
And it was a weird time.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you mentioned that your parents, when you spoke to them about ECT, they were a bit shocked to hear.
A bit shocked.
Yeah.
Pardon the pun. I think it's just that taboo and that what it actually is. And, you know, I think what people visualize it to be versus what it actually is, And I definitely feel like those commencing ECT as well as that, you know, going back to a really old school medication sort of got me through that crisis point. And it like, it's like just it can reset my brain to be able to repair.
Yeah. Mm. And I mean, it's an uncomfortable truth, I think, but ECT is very effective when it comes to depression. You know, I'm glad that A, was an option, B, that you had presented that to your care team and that they were on board with it, Andy was on board with it. Yeah. I'm assuming your parents eventually were like, whatever's going to help you, you know, we're on board.
We sent them, like, the information that had been sent to us from the hospital and then they kind of had a read of it and understood it a little bit better. But, it is a weird thing to go through because you obviously have a component of, like, mine was, instead of being bilateral, it was unilateral, to try and minimize the memory loss.
Okay.
But I do remember waking up from my first one and then the lady in recovery asking me how many children I have, and I couldn't remember having children at that time, and that was, like, terrifying.
Yeah.
About half an hour later I did, but I didn't remember initially, and I was like, it was terrible. And I just remember crying in recovery because I couldn't remember. But yeah, definitely what kickstarted my functioning again, having expression and feelings.
If that's what we need to get to a place where we're not in crisis mode so that we can continue our recovery in different ways, then thank goodness that's an option, right?
Yeah. I can't recommend it highly enough if you sort of got treatment resistant PND and if that's been presented to you, like, it's definitely worth investigating.
Yeah. And a question, what was it like, you know, going in for that first treatment? I don't think a lot of people realize you are under general anesthetic for it.
Yeah. The first time was not so bad because I, like, after waking up, not remembering I had children and waking up very panicked.
Yeah.
I was then anxious about every other time after that because I had about 6 sessions over a fortnight, about, like, alternate days, six to eight, I think. And I just remember going in and thinking, like, how was I going to wake up this time? And am I going to remember I have children?
Yeah.
Or, like, am I going to lose my memory of my little people? Or, you know, am I going to lose memory of times with my husband and my family? And, you know, I didn't want to lose those sort of components of my history and my life. So that was definitely the hesitating part. And I also remember being wheeled in a wheelchair down to the theatre and walk down a hallway and seeing people that I work with walking past me, saying hello to me and being like, why are you in a wheelchair? So, yeah. So I think that was confronting because at that point I hadn't told, like, I wasn't at that time where I felt open to talk about it. I felt very strange, like, I guess, a component of shame to it and stigma.
Of course. And, yeah, I can only imagine. It's one thing to go through it as a professional in that field. It's another thing to go through it at your place of work.
Yeah.
And in terms of the side effects, we talk about memory loss being probably one of the key parts of ECT side effects.
Yeah.
Were your side effects, in terms of memory loss, were they the short-term, and did that anxiety per each session start to ease through your treatment course?
Yeah, definitely. I think the side effects is, like, that memory loss, and definitely there's components of that section that I still don't remember. Sometimes I'll see a face and I'm like, I know that face, but I can't place it. I know there's conversations I don't remember having, people I spoke to I don't remember speaking to.
But just from that period of time?
Yeah. And, like, that's normal to a degree for that depressive episode as well. And you kind of get a headache for, like, 24 hours and they just give you some pain relief after for the headache, but that usually is just for the day after. But then I sort of felt the effect of it working, and then I felt less worried about going into it. I knew that I felt less weird about it because I knew it was working, and that for me was a relief because I, at that point, thought nothing was ever going to work and I was just going to feel like this forever.
Mm.
And that perpetuates those thoughts and...
course.
Yeah, it's terrible.
And so you've gone 6 or 8 courses of ECT. We're now towards the end of our 2-month stay at this point.
Yeah.
How were you presenting at the end compared to how you were presenting at the beginning of that admission?
I definitely felt more feelings of, like, I want to be here. I want to be present to be their mother. I want to be present to be with Andy. Like, I guess I do have something to contribute. I do have good components of me. Like, I could see those small components of becoming a mother. And, like, as I was being discharged, that's when my psychologist sort of took over as well. And I feel like, you know, the medication gets you through your crisis point, but the psychology has such a significant component to it.
Absolutely.
And I definitely felt like once I started seeing her, like, developing strategies and understanding of what's normal and how to work through those thought trains that you get of, like, I'm not enjoying today, I'm not a good mum, like, and how you acknowledge them and you can work through them. Yeah.
And was the outpatient perinatal team still in contact with you after your discharge?
Yeah, so they took over my care and I was seeing the consultant psychiatrist and the reg psychiatrist, and I had such a good team and a psychologist within there, and they, you know, and then the acute care team also did a couple of components, because it wasn't like recovery wasn't straightforward, it was up and down, like it's not linear. So there were components where I had deep downs, but then, you know, they really just kept everything going forward until Pete was one, and then they sort of hand over to my psychologist, and I still see her. But at the start, I think I was seeing her weekly, as well as the perinatal outpatient team. Now it's like 3 months, and I'm like graduating, getting there.
Oh my goodness! No, you see, I'm not even that brave to go more than a month.
Oh look, 3 months is definitely my max. Sometimes halfway through, I'm like, oh, something happened.
Yeah, what you said really touched me about how towards the end of your admission, just before discharge, you know, it's not that everything gets magically better and you're cured, but there is an element of hope that was not there beforehand.
Yeah, and that's exactly,
Yeah, as much as, you know, psychiatric hospitals or even MBUs are very intimidating concepts, you know, no one wants to go to a psychiatric hospital, right? No one, you know, thinks that that's part of their plan, but I think that their ability to provide that little bit of hope or to get you to a place where you can feel that hope is why they're so necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember the point where it sort of became more than hope. I remember I think I was sitting in the front yard with Pete and he was climbing up a slide and he just, like, he looked at me and he smiled and I just went, oh, like, there it is. I'm like, there's his love for me and that's my love, and there's my love for him, because that bond was obviously broken, and because I was broken, you know, and I knew that I loved him, but I couldn't feel it, and I couldn't feel anything other than just worthlessness. But then I remember looking at him and he looked at me and I just cried, because I was like, oh, like, this day has actually arrived, like I can feel it, and I've actually made it. I can see the light and the sun shining through. It's just a big dark cloud for a long time.
Yeah. And that's such a beautiful feeling. And I think each of us have a story, like a moment similar to that, that is our, as you said, silver lining, or the clouds are parting. We can see the light at the end of that tunnel.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad you had that moment and that you could hold on to that, because those are the things we hold on to.
Yeah, just like the relief when I felt that was insane. Yeah.
Of course. Mm. I guess, so you wrote that it was a very long treatment time and recovery, which is understandable.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've gone through a few things, you've done the ECT, they found the right medication for you.
Yep.
And that's still part of your treatment?
Yeah, so I used that to get through my crisis mode. So that was started in January, and I think about May when I was an outpatient, I sort of, my depression had sort of resolved and it was just more anxiety now. So I switched on to something that I'm still on today. Yeah. And an addition that.
The PRN?
Yeah. Just as if I get like that physical anxiety or I'm feeling a little bit overwhelmed, but I take that less and less now. But I kind of meant like, I'm still on that. Going to be a long-term thing, I think.
It keeps you well, then.
Yeah, and the stress, I don't know, the stresses of parental life and, you know, having had that experience, I can't imagine sort of coming off that and going back down. And, I'm very accepting of that's my road, and it helps me, whatever helps me to be who I am, and,
Of course, and you spoke a lot throughout this story about Andy in particular.
Yeah.
I guess if you had any comment or anything to talk about in terms of that familial or friend support, or even I'm assuming you would have spoken to your colleagues at some point down the road, how has that support impacted your story really, or your recovery?
Well, I guess when I was being wheeled down the hallway, I'm like, oh, I should probably won't be returning from mat leave. But I did. Yeah.
Awesome.
But they were very supportive. They reached out a lot. They supported me entering back into, I did change my positions just to sort of aid my transition back in. And it was actually really good for me because being a midwife is actually a significant component of who I am. So I was encouraged and I wanted to reintegrate and do that job again, and just returning and seeing everyone and everyone talking to me. And then over that first year of work, I'm like, people ask me questions and then I'd open up and then they'd ask me more questions about it. And everyone was generally interested in what my experience was and how that's changed me as a midwife and a mum. And yeah, so people were very interested, like uncomfortable sometimes, but yeah, which is fair enough.
And that was actually going to be one of my other questions, is how has your experience changed you, like as a person, as a parent, but also the way you practice midwifery?
Well, I definitely would not, if I hadn't gone through what I went through, I definitely would not have been in my own private practice with a passion of preparation throughout pregnancy for that postpartum time and significant postpartum planning. And, you know, I do work alongside, like to a degree, with people who go through that perinatal outpatient team, and the referral like comes through and, you know, we work really well together. And I think it just has helped me have an understanding about what that transition into motherhood is actually like, first time and then second time. And, you know, creating that support plan about like your inner circle of support, like your middle circle of support, then your outer circle of support, you know, discussions to have before you have your baby, like how does this look for you? What do you expect of each other? And, you know, we've all been raised differently by different parents and different generations. And then when you bring two people together to be parents together, it's going to be an evolution of your relationship. So I think supporting that and getting them ready for that is my passion.
And you can hear it in your voice.
I know.
It's good. It's a good thing.
Yeah, no, I absolutely love what I do. And even within the hospital system, like I think it's definitely helped me see, like when you have discussions with women that you're meeting very quickly for something else, and then you get a few red flags and you're like, well, how are you feeling about that, and what made you say that, and how can I support you with that? Like, I feel like I can pick those red flags up and sort of start talking to them about what they can do, and that it's okay to ask for help. And but like the typical ones, like, oh, I just don't love pregnancy, and I'm like, yeah, it's hard. It is hard on your body. It is hard on your mind, and you know, I'm sure you know that right now. And it's okay to feel like that.
I think it's important that they hear that.
And it's like okay to not love every day. I definitely feel like I can advocate much more for myself, for my children, for the women I care for.
Yeah.
Like I don't worry about, you know, I don't want to upset anyone, but I don't worry about advocating. Like if I know this is probably the best thing for them, then I will push hard. And yeah, and I'm definitely much better at setting myself boundaries and recognizing when my battery is low. And voicing that, and ear loops have been my friend.
I've had a few guests tell me about these ear loops.
Yeah. Overstimulation for me is a big thing. So just like those recognitions of things that I probably, because, you know, when you have children, you're exposed to different stressors and your life is a bit different. So you learn more about yourself, and that's definitely what I've learned. Noise. I get easily overstimulated, and I think those little recognition points where you're like, oh, I can feel it. I need some time. And I definitely don't get it right all the time.
Of course, we never do.
Yeah. No, and I think that's important. No one's perfect. Yeah.
Thank you so much for, again, talking about all of this. I know it is not easy, first of all, to have even gone through it. But I know that there's an extra layer about being able to talk openly about it. So I am utterly, first of all, in awe of you. And secondly, just so grateful that you have come on and shared about this, because I know someone will relate to what you've said, or someone will need to have heard what you've said and what you've experienced. Yeah. So thank you truly.
No, and thank you for asking me. Like, I just love what you do, and yeah, I just think you're wonderful.
Thank you to all our listeners for holding space for today's story. If you like this episode, please leave a review and rating to help me bring you more amazing content. Join the conversation and be featured on the podcast by sharing your story through my website, perinatalstoriesaustralia.com. If these stories are a bit too much to listen to or to read right now, then come back another time. Protecting your mental health is the number one priority. As always, this podcast and its associated blog and social media accounts is not a substitute for therapy or for getting help. No medical advice is provided, only lived experiences. If any of this does resonate though, please reach out to a medical professional. See you next time. Thank you again to today's sponsor, Tommy Tippy Australia. Sign up to become a VIP, a very important parent, and get 15% off your first order. See you next time.